This is Book Radio. I'm Mark Strassman. We're interviewing Gail Collins, who's just written Scorpion Tongues, Gossip, Celebrity, and American Politics. Welcome to Book Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
A little while ago, we had on this show someone named Nigel Cawthorn, who told us, or purported to tell us, true stories about the sex lives of the presidents. You have some disagreements with the stories that he's telling, particularly about, say, George Washington?
Apparently, from what I understand, he defames poor George Washington.
Well, let's resuscitate his image then.
George Washington was not, as far as I can tell, there seems to be no evidence that he had a particularly active sex life at all, let alone, you know, massive promiscuity. During the war, people always passed around rumors that whoever the general was that was running things was having sex, preferably with the other side.
Right.
Nice lady from the other side.
Right.
Nice British lady.
Well, that would have discredited him.
Yeah, and then, and also back in those days, there were frequently, if a great man paid attention to a young man, there were rumors that that was his illegitimate child. That was before the age when you had other rumors about great men and young men
right.
paid attention.
They were getting off easy.
I think, but the real rumors about George Washington, if he had had an illegitimate child, I think would have been inclined to let the world know about it. He was very sensitive to the fact that he had no children.
He, in fact, were there fertility problems
yeah.
in the family?
Well, who knows what George's problem was, but he used to pass around rumors and tell people that, you know, if Martha had been younger when they had gotten married, he would have been able to sire children, I think. And he was nervous and somewhat embarrassed by it.
So why did he marry her then?
Well, maybe he liked her. She was also incredibly wealthy, the wealthiest woman in Virginia.
So two out of three isn't bad, I guess.
The great gossip about George Washington that I found fascinating was that the other founding fathers and prominent men of the era were jealous that he got all the attention. He was the definitive hero of the period.
Right.
And they didn't regard him as all that special. And
right.
You know, a lot of sort of talk, very catty talk about, I saw him in the store and he couldn't count the change, you know.
Right.
Or I got a letter from him, you wouldn't believe the misspellings, that sort of thing.
Are these principles, let's dig up who this was exactly, are these the intellectuals like Jeffersonian
or the
Bostonians? John Adams
was
his vice president.
Yes.
But nevertheless, was bad-mouthing him.
Well, the
other
family, I think, in general, suffered from the sense that they were much smarter than whoever else was in charge of the country at any
right.
point in time.
Well, the Adams got a house at Harvard, and Washington didn't, so I guess they're still pushing that forward. Well, I mentioned Thomas Jefferson in passing, but he's probably the most renowned of the founding fathers for his sexual activities during those formative years and afterwards. Are the stories about his relations, especially with Sally Hemings and
Sally Hemings
true?
Children. Nobody knows. There's still 500 million historians locked in a room will all fight about this issue. It was a definite true piece of gossip, though. It wasn't politically manufactured. People
right.
would go to Monticello and notice that some of the younger slaves looked like Thomas Jefferson.
They had red hair and they were writing the Declaration
right,
of Independence
right
with clothes,
yes.
pens, yes.
So it was natural. How could that not become
right.
huge gossip? And then there was a guy named James Callender who was the famous sort of, you know, journalist, you know, crusading yellow journalist
right.
at the time who wrote it all down in his newspaper.
So what Reverend Weems did to make Washington look good, this guy did to make Jefferson look bad.
Yeah, Callender was for a hire journalist like most of them. He had been hired originally by Jefferson to make Alexander Hamilton look bad,
right.
but then Jefferson got sick of him and tried to slough him off, and he turned on him.
So apparently, at least at that period, the hiring and firing and procuring and recruiting of slandermongers was pretty much an important part of the political process.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at, let's say, Andrew Jackson's kitchen cabinet,
right.
the famous
right.
advisors, one of them was a guy named Simon Hill, who was the one who invented the story about John Quincy Adams being a pimp for the Tsar of Russia.
Right.
Another one was Duff Green.
You don't think that the Tsar of Russia could have gotten his own women? Being the Tsar
of
all the
think
regions,
he would really need that. Of all people. John Quincy Adams,
right.
of all people.
No.
I can't, you know, can't conceive of it.
Stomp his cane or something and get the women to come running. All right. Are you saying that rumor is or isn't true?
It is not true.
Okay.
John Quincy Adams did not get women for the Tsar of Russia, I
okay.
guarantee you.
All right. moving ahead to Andrew Jackson, who was a well-known Democrat, populist, and
mm-hmm.
person of the people. I guess it was the rich people who tried to make him look bad?
Well, the Adams people certainly did. There was a guy named Charles Hammond who was an editor in Cincinnati who started out a long series of stories about Jackson's marriage. Jackson right. and his wife Rachel had lived together while Rachel was married to someone else. She right. was very unhappily married. Later on, she got divorced and they got married. And by this time, by the election, she was an old woman and in ill health and very religious. But right. It was a true, I mean, it very clearly was a true story when it came up, the Jackson people, much like today you have all these Clinton aides who say they've never asked Bill Clinton about right. Monica Lewinsky. The Jackson people did not ask Andrew Jackson about his marriage. They asked his friends and they came up with some very painfully constructed story about how it could be possible that they could have lived together but not lived together. In a
it was an accident. They just happened to be renting rooms in the same boarding house
they
or something.
It was a painful story about how they thought she was divorced and they got
right.
wrong information and then with, imagine their surprise when they found out that she wasn't. But the upshot of the story, of course, was that, that Mrs. Rachel Jackson was heartbroken by these,
right.
this terrible stuff that was being printed. Awful stuff. You know, how can we have this woman, this horror in the White House, yada yada.
So this is pretty much, the gossip is always done without any regard for the feelings of the person against whom it's done. In fact, sometimes with an active disregard in order to hurt them and cause damage. I mean, people, some of this was used not to really fool around with. This was used to hurt people, get them out of office, derail their plans, and advance the plans of the people who are putting it forward.
Well, Rachel Jackson, who... Jackson adored his wife, and she died right before the inauguration, and
right.
some of the papers wrote things saying, how lucky for Mrs. Jackson that she does not have to go on and be, you know, this object of contempt
right.
in Washington that we would certainly make her.
Well, I'm sure she would have had mixed feelings about that. Grover Cleveland, Mama, where's my pa gone to the White House?
Anybody remembers about Grover Cleveland. He is my favorite president for being gossiped about.
Well,
in
Kennedy
American
was elected
history.
Two times. Wasn't
Actually,
he
was elected
terms.
Three times, and the middle time he lost the electoral college, but he won three straight popular elections,
right.
Despite the fact that he was constantly tormented by awful newspaper stories about his private life.
He was pretty much at that. He was in the 1870s?
1884 was his first election, so he went through the last... decade and a half.
So he's really at the crux, at the cusp of the emergence of celebrity and gossip as a
he was
national
president
industry.
At the same time that John L. Sullivan, who was really the first entertainment celebrity, the
right.
great prize fighter, came on the scene.
Right.
And in fact, John L. Sullivan went to the White House and shook Grover Cleveland's hand, and
right.
the people there were much more excited to see
right.
John L. Sullivan than the president when he came.
Right. So in fact, again, sort of the tendencies of the time were crystallized in General Sullivan and President Cleveland and so on as embodiments
yeah.
of the trends and
Cleveland story is such a great story.
Well, tell us.
If they're ever making a movie about a 300-pound president, this is the story to make.
Right, better than Taft?
Oh, better than Taft, so much better. He, you know, this great story about this illegitimate child, you know, I looked at endlessly, and I don't think it was his child. It was
right.
pretty clearly the child of his law partner, Oscar Folsom.
So he was seen with him, or he...
Oscar Folsom had died.
Okay.
And he had been married, and...
Right.
Cleveland was the guardian of his daughter, his young daughter, Frankie.
His illegitimate daughter.
No.
Oh, his real daughter.
Oscar Folsom's real daughter.
His real daughter.
His real family.
His legitimate
right.
daughter, right.
So there was this illegitimate child bouncing around, and
right.
Cleveland took care of it and had it adopted. And then when this story came out right after his nomination, he clammed up, didn't say anything, told people not to say anything, wouldn't let anyone defend him.
Why not?
Because he was madly in love with Frankie Folsom, the daughter whose guardian he was, who was the half-sister, as it turned out.
Okay.
It's sort of like a Thomas Hardy novel.
Right.
But
so he was in love with the half-sister of the person who was rumored to be the
right,
father
exactly.
of him. What happened in that relationship?
They got married.
Oh, good.
Right after the election. They got
okay.
married, and they were very happily married, but... During this period, during the campaign, not only did he have the illegitimate child thing hanging on him,
right.
but outrageous stories printed about how he was seen naked and bloody and drunk in bar rooms fighting over prostitutes and had despoiled dozens of virgins all over the nation and so on and so forth.
Tell us very briefly about the career of President Cleveland's step-brother-in-law and reputed son.
The fabled illegitimate child
right.
grew up to be one of the nation's most famous and prominent gynecologists, and he specialized in hysterectomies, and before there was much anesthetic and you had to do things very quickly, could do two, three, or four of them at a time, apparently,
right.
and that was his claim to fame.
So he was apparently eager to rip out the reproductive
capability. Oh, that's a tough one, but
as a way of sort of dealing with his own ambiguity
something
and dealing
in
about
there,
his,
anyway,
his own origins. President McKinley, on the other hand, was a pillar of probity.
President McKinley had a wife, a very strange wife, who was epileptic in some way, and who, you know, was very possessive about him and demanded his presence all the time, and he was utterly devoted to her and never left her side when he could help it. He kept her right close to him even when he was in the White House.
He was uxorious.
Very nice word there.
Never get to use that very often.
And whenever she'd have a fit while dining at, they said, at, you know, presidential meals, she would just put a napkin over her until, you know, she got through it and then continued with meal.
But even this was not enough to protect him from...
Well, you know, the interesting thing about, he was gossiped about as a wife beater during the campaign. The rumors went around. Cleveland was gossiped about as a wife beater. Woodrow Wilson later was gossiped about as a man who may have murdered his first wife. I think that all of this stuff, which all happened around the turn of the century, had a lot to do with the fact that people were beginning to focus on the plight of women at the mercy of drunken husbands. The temperance movement was gaining strength.
Jack the Ripper,
sense that poor women were being abused. The Settlement House movement was coming, and there was just sort of a sensitivity to these issues, and I think it expressed itself a little bit in these constant rumors that great men were abusing their wives, even though all these men were particularly devoted husbands.
After sex, I think money has been the big issue, or has it been substance abuse?
Money comes up once in a while, conspicuous consumption gossip at times when the nation is insecure about their own finances. Martin Van Buren became president when there was a terrible, terrible financial panic going on, and tons of stories about him dining on silver spoons and claims that he had sculpted the lawns of the White House to represent Amazon's bosoms with, you know, all kinds of strange stuff. But and that also that he wore corsets because he had gotten so fat eating all this food while the country was starving. It's like a little bit like Nancy Reagan's Red China and, you know, all that the stuff about Nancy Reagan buying expensive dresses.
Red China, her China for eating, not the Red China.
Her literal Red China.
Beijing,
yes.
What have you found is then the best strategy to adopt when attacked by gossip for a political figure?
It depends. Often if you go directly at it, it stops. Theodore Roosevelt was just tortured by gossip that he was an alcoholic, which he wasn't. And I think it was because he was a very excessive personality. He sort of always looked like he was on something because he was sort of hopping around.
You got that feeling just watching a documentary about him that he was on speed.
He looked like
least.
He was stimulated in some way. And so people constantly would ask reporters wherever they went in the country, is it true that he drinks? So he drinks a lot. And he was worried that he would go down in history as the drunken president.
No, he's safe.
Well, what happened was he took it on. He found a little tiny paper that printed the story, said, you know, and in an editorial, he's a terrible president. Besides that, he drinks all the time.
Right.
And he sued this little weeny paper in Ishpeming, Michigan for libel, took the entire press corps up there, had this big libel trial, proved that he didn't drink, and finally the publisher got in the stands, this poor little beleaguered publisher, and said, I admit it, no one's ever seen him drunk. I heard the rumors, and I published them. I'm sorry. And Roosevelt jumped up and said, no damages, I'm content, and walked away.
On the way over here, in the unbearable Los Angeles traffic, I was listening to The World on National Public Radio, and among the stories that were covered were the looming genocide in Kosovo, the heritage of communism and Nazism in Berlin, the mafia control of Sicily, and efforts in Northern Ireland to end the bloodshed there that's killed 3,000 people since 1969. Are we Americans pretty lucky that our politics mainly consists of arguing about who the president is sleeping with?
Yeah, and you know, although many people now think we've come into some new pit of abyss of bad behavior and moral degeneracy because all this stuff is going on, if you look at the patterns of gossip about politicians through American history, I think the fact that we're gossiping about sex is incredibly healthy compared to the things that were said about presidents in previous days. Well, I used to talk about who is secretly Jewish, who is secretly Catholic, who is secretly black, hateful stuff that you know, it seems to me that if we just sit around talking about who's sleeping with who, it's probably a great thing.
I think I agree with you. How did you come to be involved as an expert in this field and a writer about it?
I work for the New York Times. I'm on the editorial board, and my agent had asked me if I was interested in doing a book on the history of gossip per se, and I looked at it, kind of fooled around with it, and my specialty is politics, and it was clear that the part of it that I could really do and that I found interesting was the history of how people have talked about the private lives of politicians through American history and what it meant, how it affected the politicians and the politics.
Okay, so why don't we take it back, maybe, let's take it back way far. I'm thinking Greece. I'm thinking prehistory. Where did gossip come from?
We have gossiped ever since there was privacy. As soon as we invented privacy, we started speculating about what people were doing when they were having it.
Was there much of a tradition or in the colonies before there was a United States?
Well, the tradition of gossiping about political figures goes back to ancient Athens, certainly, when everybody gossiped about Pericles and Pericles' mistress and whether or not she was secretly having orgies and whether or not he really wore his helmet because his head was shaped like a pear and on and on and on. And you know, Mark Antony spread rumors about Julius Caesar sleeping with Octavius. It's a grand human tradition.
In fact, one of the main aspects of that tradition is to use gossip as a weapon.
Yeah.
Tell us sort of how that has tended to work in American politics.
Early on in America, the newspapers were utterly unprofitable when it came to, you couldn't sell ads, there were virtually no ads, circulations were really weeny.
They're kind of like newsletters.
Yeah, and people hardly ever paid their bills, their subscription rates, so editors to survive really needed political patronage, either printing contracts or jobs. Many of them had jobs in government of one sort or another, no-show jobs. And they're the whole point of their papers was to slander the opposition and fluff up your side, no matter what was going on.
Not so, very unbiased.
No, I mean, they used to have a great headline in newspapers back then called Important If True.
Right.
Covers all bases.
When was the heyday of these media for hire operations?
Oh, from the beginning of from the Revolution on to the Civil War, really, where you had really sort of make-believe newspapers. There were much more editorial sheets than real newspapers.
And each of those papers had its own party, and each of the parties had its own papers.
Virtually. For instance, the great election in that period was 1828, when Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams were running, and the Jackson people ran stories claiming that the reason that Adams had been such a successful diplomat was because he had procured women for the Tsar of Russia. You know? And then the Adams people endlessly wrote about how Jackson had slept with his wife and she was married to somebody else.
Well, we're going to touch on it again, and probably again and again, but why is sex always such a big subject of gossip, including political gossip?
Well, it counts for a great deal of human activity, certainly a great deal of human misbehavior, but it's not the only thing people have gossiped about. Often, alcoholism and drinking was a very big subject, especially in periods when there was a lot of drinking going on. People were getting anxious about overconsumption issues.
And in fact, that's an example of your general theory, that it's what's worrying people at any particular time as a group that forms the focus of the gossip.
Yeah, I think you can learn a lot about the way the nation was feeling at any point in time by looking at what things they were saying about their politicians.
These public concerns that became the gossip topic of choice, did they tend to be multi-focused or sort of one topic would predominate at any particular time?
Depends on the era. Sometimes, especially, say, right before the Civil War, when people were utterly fixated on one thing, that really did tend to dominate the discourse. Right before the Civil War, there was tons of speculation about people sleeping with slaves or having slave mistresses or being secretly Negro and, Abraham Lincoln was secretly black. Everybody was secretly black.
So the focal issues, which have sort of been sex and identity and perverse habits and perverse substance abuse habits, sort of tend to attach themselves then to whatever the substantive issue is that's predominating in the political discourse.
Yeah. Of course, there are exceptions. Sometimes you simply have a president who's a philanderer, whether people are nervous about it or not. There you are.
Okay. Then was gossip a part of the warfare of each side in the Civil War?
Yeah. Any war, there tends to be gossip that, especially an unpopular war, that whoever's in charge is a profiteer or somehow, getting an advantage of it. There were that gossip about Lincoln, that he, told jokes on the battlefield, didn't care. And, the same gossip was spread around about Lyndon Johnson during the war in Vietnam. A lot of gossip during World War II that Franklin Roosevelt's sons were somehow getting out of the draft or not really serving, stuff like that.
After the Civil War, the U.S. Embarked on a long period of economic growth and
the Gilded Age.
And the Gilded Age. What did people find the gossip about then?
It was a period of enormous political corruption, but it was also a period in which newspapers were changing. You know, the stuff that they became more professional, but they also became larger and much more competitive. And suddenly you needed to get circulation so you could have ads. And the entertainment factor became very important. People were moving into cities, and although they still loved to gossip, they didn't have common neighbors anymore, and the newspapers really created a celebrity class for them to talk about.
So in fact, the market was taking over from the political party as the dominant force in
shaping. Gossip became a commodity, yeah.
Right, okay. And so in order to make it a commodity, as you're saying, a class of celebrities needed to be created. How did that happen? Who did it? How did it work?
Well, early on, the celebrities were often politicians or rich people. There were rich people around and politicians. And then around the turn of the century, the entertainment industry was created for the first time. Up until then, you know, people didn't go to the theater because it was very rowdy. Many places in the country, you couldn't dance or play cards because it was considered immoral. There was nothing else to do but politics. Politics was the great entertainment factor of the 19th century. You got to have parties and picnics and parades and fireworks and stuff like that, and that was all part of the whole system.
So, in fact, the reason that entertainment is so much more popular these days than politics is because it has sort of skimmed off the entertainment value of the politics, and since it was at the turn of the century where the mass immigration, the increase in technology, and the market forces that you were talking about all coalesced to create the possibility of an economics of celebrity and gossip.
And you know, we haven't talked at all here about the moral fiber of the nation.
No, we haven't.
I think it's pretty clear that the moral fiber of the nation is not a major factor in determining whether or not, you know, there's going to be scandals, rumors, and gossip about politicians. It's other factors.
You mean in preventing it or in preventing its discussion?
Either way, people like to gossip about celebrities, and they will gossip about politicians if there's something really interesting about about a politician that they find interesting. But frankly, in the early 20th century, it was more fun to talk about Rudolph Valentino's sex life than Calvin Coolidge's sex life.
Although Warren Harding apparently had something going for him.
Warren Harding had a great sex life. Apparently, he was when he was running for office, the Republican National Committee sent his mistress, Carrie Phillips, and her husband, who used to be Harding's best friend until he found out about this 20-year affair that had been going on, to the Far East to investigate the silk trade to keep them out. And then, of course, when he was in office, he had a mistress named Nan Britton, and they used to have sex in the closet of the Oval Office.
The same closet that the current president is alleged to have?
No, interestingly, the closet, as I understand it now, is used by his secretary, the same poor secretary that was dragged before the special prosecutor, grand jury.
In thinking about what you're saying in Scorpion Tongues and the conversation we've had today, it seems to me that what's emerging here is gossip and the media as a means by which society is able to establish a conversation and within itself and determine what it actually deems to be proper social behavior.
You're right. Often attacking people for something, saying, "Oh my heavens, look at that man, he didn't dress properly for church."
Right.
Is a way of saying, "I believe in dressing properly for church. We should all do that together."
Right, and the ensuing debate about how one needs to dress for church or how one needs to treat one's interns then becomes a referendum mediated by the very well-organized polls of CNN and Time and Gallup and shown almost instantaneously on the television.
But what the polls are not able to show right now because of the complication of the legal proceedings I think if there is rage, and there probably is, about some of the things that the president's purported to have done, it's being somewhat masked by the fact that the people think these questions are asking them whether he should be impeached.
Right.
Whether they want to vote him out of office somehow.
Right. So,
and they don't. They're not voting on private behavior.
Well, the politics is kind of getting in the way, in a sense, but it's the politics and the various players in the political drama that bring the charges up and therefore put them into the public realm and therefore generate the possibility of having the polls, which then allow the people as a whole, or at least their statistically significant representatives, to say how they feel about it, and therefore the border, the line between proper conduct and improper conduct is established, but in a sense by a vote of the people.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it. You're right. It also, you know, gossip is also an important way of learning things.
Right.
You need information on how people behave in private to judge how your own private life
right.
is going. If you
right.
didn't, if your husband is straying, you need to know what happens in other marriages.
Exactly.
This is the only husband who's ever straying,
right.
or are they all straying,
right.
and how do other wives respond to it? Things like that.
Right.
And you learn a lot, but just by the story of Dwight Eisenhower and his chauffeur, Kate
right.
Summerbee,
right.
by listening to her and what she says happened, you learn a lot about what you can and cannot expect from a man with, who you're having an affair with in time of war,
right.
or in a summer vacation, for that matter.
Right. So people then learn what the socially accepted standards are, and they learn how they're supposed to behave in a way,
mm-hmm.
so that everyone now sort of probably knows what to do if an intern starts fawning over you, and what your options are,
right.
and what you
can
do.
And if you're an intern, you learn what might
right.
happen if the great
right.
man deigns to
right.
to give you his favors.
And what happens if you give him yours, and if you talk about it, truly or not, to a so-called friend, and so on. So people are learning how to cope with these new situations, I guess. Two last questions. How do you see the future of gossip? I guess in light of the new media.
Mm-hmm.
We're on the internet now. There's a person whose name I won't mention, but he has a report named after him, who's made a career out of being a gossip, essentially. He models himself on Walter Winchell, who invented
right.
being a gossip. And it's reached pretty serious legal proportions in some cases.
It's an interesting question about the internet on two levels. One is the freedom of people to write whatever they want on the internet.
Right.
If you're held somehow accountable for the truth of what you say, it changes the ability, you know, the open discourse.
Yes.
On the other hand, right now, especially if you look in the chat rooms, the political chat rooms, whatever, the stuff that's going on there is so bizarre and
right.
so totally out of context
right.
that it's not interesting.
Right.
And somehow you're going to have to get an accountability factor in there somewhere in order to make
right.
this stuff at all useful for the general population.
Right. So the internet does have a great potential as a mechanism of gossip.
Oh, it's going to be huge. It already is. An email especially just sort of
right.
moves things around everywhere in the world.
Idea,
do
you think it will happen, and do you think it's good if it does, that gossip and celebrity and media, the confluence of this, is going to totally drown politics so that there is none left to speak of?
Something is going to change in politics. The last time we went through a period that was this intense, my favorite Grover period, was followed by a period of great discretion as far as writing and reporting on the private lives of politicians.
Right.
I think it's got a lot more to do with the structure of the political parties and the fact that they're falling apart.
Right.
Something will happen and something new will evolve, and when it does, you know, this desperate sort of striving after personality and it will probably diminish. It's right now we're into it so much because everybody is a personality. There aren't any parties. There's just a bunch of guys out there trying to get attention because
right.
they want to
well,
be
it's
elected.
Very pernicious because one of the reasons television, I think, in its pseudo honest moments, says it doesn't cover politics because no one's interested in it and therefore no one wants to see it. But on the other hand, by not covering it for free, but covering it very well, if you pay them money to run the commercials, they're in a powerful position to make money, which is what they're in business to do.
Here's how this all winds up in gossip. You've got all these candidates who desperately need to get attention because they're each a freelance person trying to make their name and get themselves elected.
Right.
In order to do that, they've got to make themselves available in ways that politicians in the past didn't have to.
Right.
They have to go on all the radio shows. They have to go on MTV and talk about their underwear. They have to, you know, do whatever it takes to get noticed.
Right.
In an atmosphere in which nobody really cares very much about them. So
right.
the degree to which they're made to look foolish
right.
gets higher and higher.
Right.
When that happens, you've lost the shield of dignity that a president or even a senator or a governor used
right.
to have.
Right.
They're much more vulnerable to talk about other things. It's much easier to talk about the shape of the private parts of a president
right.
when that president has already been on Don Imus and has already played the saxophone in Arsenio Hall and has in many other ways made himself much more average and like a regular person than a president in the days of old.
Not even average, but degraded.
Yeah.
Because he has to degrade himself in order to get the note. to say one last thing about that, about the paradox and contradiction between the necessity to be bizarre to get attention and the necessity to be normal in order to be seen as viable.
You know, an interesting example is Ross Perot. You know, Ross Perot got attention because he was sort of seemed to be sort of peculiar and sort of, you know, bigger than life, even though he was a smaller person who was bigger than life.
Right.
And his ideas interested people. I mean, the 92 campaign was the best campaign I think I ever covered when it came to the average citizens really focusing on the issues at hand.
And in addition to being slightly unusual and bigger than life and having some good ideas, he also had several $1 billion to get people's attention to. So that didn't hurt.
What we need is a great big billionaire who's not crazy, I guess.
Okay, well, we'll see if Al Checky is that. Okay, so thank you very much for talking to us about Scorpion Tongues, Gossip, Celebrity, and American Politics, Gail Collins, and good luck with it. And I suppose you've become a gossip magnet as a result of writing this book, and everyone gives you all the latest material.
Everyone can feel free to call me with everything they know.
All right, good. All right, thanks very much.